Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cult of Gracie on XXBN, broadcasting from Fargo, North Dakota. XXBN is located in Raleigh, North Carolina. Tonight we have with us Amanda Brooks, who is an author and activist. Her book series is the Internet Escorts Handbook Series. Book one, The Foundation, Basic Mental, Emotional, and Physical Considerations in Escort Work, is out and is tremendous. And her second book is on marketing and advertising, and that's due out sometime this summer. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
Thank you.
As you know, I've had your book for, 300 years, and I just finally got around to doing the review, basically because, as I had mentioned to you, I've been telling everyone what a great book it is. A couple of things that struck me right away before we get into the escort things is I was struck by the multiple other people that could read this book and get something out of it. Escort, those considering working in escort, definitely. Mm-hmm. But also phone sex operators and others who want to work in any form of adult, in the adult industry. While your book is clearly more tailored to in-person work, I was really struck by a lot of the things that you pointed out about what the business is and isn't and misconceptions. And I was wondering how much thought you put into that when you wrote the book.
I was, especially when I discussed misconceptions, I was definitely considering the larger picture of sex work in general because, I've stripped and I've worked as an escort, and I've certainly heard those misconceptions in both fields from, civilians. So I think a lot of people have the same misconceptions, whether you're an escort or a stripper or phone sex operator, dominatrix. I mean, they lump it all sex work together into one really rather derogatory category.
Yeah. And
so, I was addressing broader concerns when I addressed a lot of the stereotypes.
And you write with great humor.
Thank you.
It's sort of conversational. I really liked when you talked about in the beginning about what a prostitute is and isn't, and you said escort is just another word for prostitute, and you wrote, honestly, no. If you're selling your time, undivided attention, and the unspoken offer of sexual entertainment, you're an escort. If you're selling a specific sexual activity for a certain amount of money, you're a prostitute. If you won't have sex with a man you're dating unless he buys you an expensive dinner, you're a relatively cheap prostitute. And it's things like that in the book that make you kind of stop and grin for a minute, because it does kind of provide context. Some people would argue that marriage is a form of prostitution.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
That was actually in the first draft, but after some discussion with my partner, I ended up taking out that comment and just leaving in the dinner date comment. But, yeah, I actually did put marriage into the first draft, and my partner felt that it would be a little too inflammatory.
Yeah, maybe it's inflammatory, but I think for anyone who's considering the work, to get an idea of perspective here of what is an economic gain for what is a companionship and or sexual act, is they're pretty comparable, I think. I mean, they're apples and oranges, if nothing else. You're not comparing apples to pizzas. So, it's rather related. The other thing that I was struck by in the book was while you spend a lot of time on appearance and the physical things that one might experience as an escort, I thought there were a lot of things there that were eye-opening to some but really confirmed my experiences in business. You talk quite a bit about the number one thing that as an escort that you're going to need to do with clients is to listen, be a good listener, and a conversationalist. And that's something that always has surprised my friends when they've asked about my former work.
Well, that goes back to the stereotypes everybody has about it. They all think it's prostitution, and I'm in no way putting down prostitutes. Prostitution, like I said, is simply sex for money. It's a very simple thing to do. And, everybody thinks escort work is just that, but true escort work is definitely more complex and can be a lot more emotionally draining.
Yeah.
Dealing with the clients, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people, you know, in the media, they want to talk about this romanticizing escort work or prostitution as a, you know, that we're tacking on this companionship layer, or that, you know, no one really gets taken to the movies or out dinner. It's all about sex. And that if we point that out, that that is a true part of the business, we're accused of romanticizing it or whitewashing it, trying to lure other people in. And yet my experience was that was 90% of my appointment time.
Yeah, I don't see it as luring people in so much as just speaking the truth about the experiences you're going to expect. Because if you go in there expecting to be banged into the middle of next week, you're actually going to be shocked when that doesn't happen. Oh,
yeah.
That's my take on it.
No, you have said that when you wrote this book, that you wrote it for the fundamental reason that when you were entering escort work, you really didn't know, you didn't even have a resource for yourself.
Yeah, I'm a reader, so naturally my first thing, I went to Amazon, and there's really, at the time, there was really no good reference. I mean, there was Turning Pro by Magdalene Meretrix, and that was the most recent reference that I could find, and she doesn't devote a lot of time to escort work, really. She does, you know, every chapter is actually discussing a different aspect of the sex industry, so she doesn't devote a lot of time to any aspect. And, I mean, at the time, that was the only reference. And I like to have books. I like to have references. So immediately, yes, the plans were laid for writing a book that would answer all the questions that I had.
Well, and you know that with Swap East and most sex worker organizations, one of the things we talk about is that if you want to enter sex work, you need to be able to consent to it. And I'm still very strongly that the ability to consent is based on the amount of education or information you have on a topic. So you really can't consent to being a sex worker if you don't understand what it is.
And that is beautifully put. Yes, I always say knowledge is power, but you're right. In this case, knowledge creates consent. That's wonderful. That's a great point. Okay, that is a great point.
Well, I think I wrote it in my review. You can cut and paste it if you need to.
I will.
One of the things that I was struck by at the book is you go through the aspects on appearance. You cover everything from shaving and Brazilians, and even though the general opinion of the public would be that in order to be an escort is that you need to look like Barbie and you need to hang from chandeliers and you need to be, you know, sort of limber. And while those things can be helpful, I'm assuming, in certain areas of escort work for, you know, your niche, so to speak. Really, it's about being attractive or really more precisely about being, you know, not repelling a possible client.
Yeah, I mean, everybody has their own personal best. I mean, we all have our own personal best, and this is just, you need to be aware of what your personal best is and achieve it. And not only are you going to feel good about yourself, but your business will certainly grow from that. Because, I mean, everybody knows when you're looking your best. It's just that simple. But that doesn't mean your best is the same as, say, you know, Angelina Jolie's best. And nobody expects that from you.
No, and I think that's really true. Back when I started escorting and I worked for an agency, one of the girls there that will get calls less and less over time. I can say her working name was Tiffany. I had never met her before, but calls started coming in less and less for her, and some of the girls were talking about it, and I was part of the conversation, if mostly silently. And it turns out that, you know, she started doing calls only from her home, and literally, like, answering the door in a T-shirt and, you know, bedhead and...
Oh, God.
You know, and her calls went out over time. Yeah, and I started thinking, you know, to myself, wow, you know, like, it had never occurred to me to do that because I wouldn't show up for a job interview looking like that. Mm-hmm. And when you're meeting a client or you're, you know, that's the same sort of presentation ability. And I think that, you know, she didn't last too much longer at that point. But I think there's a certain, either people expect sex workers to look like Barbie, or they have the other extreme opinion, which is that we're lazy drug addicts who have no ability to take care of ourselves. And so I appreciate...
Yeah, well, sometimes clients, I mean, I've certainly run into that before. Clients also have these expectations because it's so funny because I've had clients, I've gone to their hotel, and they've been pleasantly surprised when they open the door because they, even though they you know, screened with me and set up an appointment and they're willing to spend X amount of dollars, they still, in the back of their mind, expect me to show up, you know, in fishnets and high heels and a miniskirt chewing gum.
Yeah.
And then when they see me, it's like relief. Oh, my gosh, he doesn't look like that.
Well, yeah, and I think that's why a lot of clients would meet the first time in a public place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd be terrified of who it was going to be that they wouldn't walk up to if you didn't meet the, you know, what they thought they could walk out of there with. Or they would meet in a very, very private place and then take you to the public place when they realized you had, you know, you weren't going to draw attention to yourself by looking out of place.
Yeah, that definitely goes back to all those stereotypes that everyone believes. Or not everyone, but almost everyone believes.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to dispel some of those.
Yeah, that's true. In the first book, you cover a lot of really basic, and I think it's been called by others on the internet that it's sort of a sex work 101, and that's true. Mm-hmm. For myself, not having been an escort for a number of years now, I was some things have changed and some things have not. For instance, the idea of the hobbyist just really amused me, because we didn't really, before the internet, didn't really have such a method for the hobbyist to be as, I don't know, much of a hobbyist as he is. Maybe you could explain that to the listening, what a hobbyist is.
Okay. A hobbyist is, due to the internet discussion and review boards have sprung up like wildflowers. And hobbyists are the men that just live and die on these review boards, and they live and die by escort reviews and escort discussions. And, I mean, they spend an enormous amount of time and energy tracking and discussing escorts in their local community, or sometimes touring escorts, but usually they focus on the local escorts in their community. And now there might be something, you know, inherently unhealthy on someone who spends that much time devoted online to one topic, no matter what that topic is. But generally, they tend to be just harmless. They can be annoying, certainly, because they always want a discount for being a hobbyist. But beyond that, they're typically harmless. The problem, though, is that some of them feel that they have power over a girl because of their community status and the power in their reviews. And then it starts into a really ugly business of basically review coercion, in which they try to extort various sexual favors out of the girl, you know, threatening to leave them with a really bad review and destroy their business if the girl doesn't do what they want. And that's a huge dark side to it.
Yeah, in the book you refer to the hobby pimp.
Yes, hobby pimps. Yeah.
And you have an excellent quote there about that they try to give you advice on your business because they've used professional services before. They know what you should do with your business. And you compare that to, you know, me telling Bill Gates how to run Microsoft because I use a few of his programs.
Yeah, I think it's very audacious of them to do that. They have no idea what each individual girl's situation is, where she might be in her life, why she structures her business the way she does. They have no idea, and it takes a lot of gall for them to come up and tell her, this is how you need to do it because this is how I think it should be run. They don't know. They've never walked a mile in her shoes. And, I mean, I'm not saying that I have either, because I'm not going to go and tell some girl how she should run her business either. The only thing I do is present options, and she chooses whatever she wants to do based on, you know, her own situation.
Well,
I'm not going to even tell somebody this is how you need to run your business.
Yeah, I think that was one of the best things about your book, is that you presented the questions or the situations, and you ask the reader to consider what they would do in this situation, how they would feel about this situation before they're put into it. You know, when I started, I started at an agency, and mm-hmm. I learned from the other women that work there when I had questions, and I learned very quickly that, you know, while we didn't have the message board forum rating option, not every client was going to like you.
Yeah.
And that was going to come down to kind of like the person who's in the mood for, you know, Chinese food ending up at McDonald's and not being happy. Well, they should have gone to the, you know, Chinese buffet down the road. Some things you're just not going to be able to deal with, and you have to learn to walk that off. But when it comes to your business and you're new and you're starting out, and someone who claims to know things and says, well, the other girls do, or you have to in order to, you know, you can feel pressured into doing something you wouldn't want to do. And your book really presents those ahead of time so that the escort or the person thinking of becoming an escort can say to themselves, wow, this is where I want to draw the line for myself, and this is what I'm going to say when I'm in that situation.
Yeah, because I had that situation very early on, and that's why it's actually such a big issue for me, because I was just in the first few weeks of my debut in Dallas, I was actually going along quite well, but there was a local hobbyist there who wanted to meet me for cocktails, and I had some spare time, so I thought, sure, why not? And he was nice, but he started telling me how I should run everything, including who I should and should not be friends with, and, I mean, just unasked, deciding to step into my life and tell me how I should run it. That really put me off of hobbyists right from the very beginning. That was just way too much. Nobody is going to tell me who my friends should and should not be. That was a lot of gall.
Well, I think that comes down to the perception of what an escort is. If the perception is that we're so down on our luck that we'd be willing to do this, that then we're somehow susceptible or to the guidance, you know, that we're at the mercy of it because we really aren't able to make decisions for ourselves.
Yeah, you're right. I think that was the underlying insult that I probably picked up and took offense at. I certainly wasn't consciously thinking it out. I was just simply offended that this guy would be telling me how to run my life. But, yeah, the underlying insult is that I'm incapable of running my own life and making my own decisions. And, of course, a girl who is starting out and is feeling insecure about it all, yeah, she is definitely susceptible to these ploys. And I've certainly seen girls being brought into the fold, and they are very new and very insecure at it, and they only listen to these hobbyists. And I'm not saying that they end up in terrible situations, but at the same time, they often end up very unhappy with the business because the only side of it they've seen is extremely controlled, and it's created to the advantage of these men, and it's not created to her advantage.
Well,
I do see a lot of problems with this.
Well, and I know it seems to be a problem in a lot of online communities where business ratings can occur. I know I've heard from some of the people that work as phone sex operators with Night Flirt, and they have a review system there and like Red Diaries and things like that. And the client can leave a rating, but there's no feedback for the client, which I still find rather amazing. You know, even at eBay, you can, you know, the buyer and the seller can both leave feedback for one another. There's an equal ground there, but as a service provider, if you aren't able to leave feedback or even address the feedback left for you, I feel that shows some sort of inequity as to who's really in control.
Yes, and that's true on most escort discussion and review boards because they are created for the men. They're not, I mean, they provide the women with a great advertising venue and a good networking venue, but otherwise they're basically created for the needs of the men, and yes, their policies obviously reflect this.
Yeah, so by reading your book, an escort can decide, you know, how they want to handle those things and what, you know, how many of those things they want to deal with, if they're just going to work in one community or if they can handle seven of them.
Yeah, I discuss that more in book two, you know, advertising and marketing, because the whole online communities, discussion boards, and review boards definitely come into play there. Because they can either be a great advertising venue for you, or they can be this really terrible time suck, or they can just, you know, weave their way into your life in a really insidious way. Because, I mean, I've seen all of those situations happen.
The other thing I wanted to mention about the first book was when I was reading it, while it is clearly written for someone considering a career in sex work, or even someone who's in it who maybe is moving to the, you know, more on the internet. One of the things that struck me is that the information in here on, let's say, for example, STDs, you go quite clearly in the, you know, what's out there, condoms.
Yes. I love latex.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is we often hear sex workers is that we're sex workers, escorts, prostitutes. If somebody gives us an extra $5 or $10 to go without the condom, to go bareback, that we're stupid not to take it. And this drives me crazy because no one would ever think that if someone told a firefighter, I will pay you $10 more if you go in without your gear, you know, it's life or death. So I don't see how women or male sex workers would go for it.
I think the problem is lack of education. I've certainly seen, I've known girls who will do this, and I've certainly seen clients, you know, hobbyists who trade tips on how to do this, and I've certainly had clients who tried to bribe their way into condomless sex as well. And I think what really happens is, again, the girls enter the business without any solid foundation in knowing what they're getting into, and they believe the hobbyist claims that STDs aren't that widespread, or you can't catch it because the saliva in your mouth will kill the germs, and this sort of thing. And they get terrible misinformation from the hobbyist, when in truth women are at a much bigger risk of getting any STD you can name, just because of, you know, biologically how we're built. And I think a lot of the reason that it does unfortunately happen is simply sheer ignorance.
Well, this is one of the issues that's always bothered me whenever the conversations come up about decriminalizing sex work, and people will point to the brothels in Vegas and discuss how, you know, that it would be healthier because all the women have to be, you know, as I call it, vet checked, and they got to get their stamp on their rump, and then they can proceed to work at the cat house.
Yes.
But clients don't have to go through this.
Yes, I know. It's always irked me, too, because women, I mean, just, you know, checking women every single week, that's so invasive, and it's so very expensive, too. I also love the fact that they're blaming the women for the spread of disease, when the women are the one who are stationary objects there, and it's the clients who are coming and going from the outside world. I just find that interesting to me, but that's my opinion, I guess.
Well, and you mentioned in the book about how you can check for obvious signs of sores or outbreaks, you know, on a man's penis, but that it's not a guarantee of anything that is or isn't there.
No, definitely not, because everyone should know that every STD out there can be completely symptomless on a man or a woman, but it's much higher percentage of symptomless STDs in men, because they often will carry what small symptoms they have within their penis where you cannot see it. But the skin cells and, you know, the virus or bacteria will still slough off while you're giving him a blowjob or a handjob or having unprotected sex with him. It will slough off and end up inside you. But, the famous DC is not foolproof by any means.
Yeah. Well, all of this information, when I put it all together and I was looking at it from the, you know, teeth whitening to what to do with a used condom to the fact that listening is important, when I put all this together, I was struck with the fact that this is not only good information for a person considering a career change or expanding their career choice, it would be it's excellent information for people who constantly, and I'm sure you get asked this a lot, what kind of person would be a sex worker? Answers those questions, or what's it like to be one? It answers those questions. If you've got a spouse or a partner that either has a history of or that you know is seeing a sex worker and using those services, the why is he doing that is kind of outlined in this book, but. The coolest thing about this book, and you can tell me if I'm crazy, but this really is like how to date. This is really about how to be safe.
Yes, that's what my partner keeps telling me, is I need to write a dating book based on escort work. And I don't think he's wrong. It's just I haven't, surely have not started that yet. But, yeah, it I don't know how to get that message across to the mainstream, but women who are dating need to know how to set emotional boundaries. They need to understand the sexual risk that they face. And they need to understand that it's okay to have the power, and that they do have the power, and that they can set their rules. They can control the situation.
Say yes to this and no to that, and not be a good or a bad girl, just a safe girl.
Yeah, exactly. A smart girl. That's all there is to it. Escort work is no different from dating. It really is not. It's maybe higher volume.
You still choose if you want to go out. You still choose what your limits are.
Yes. Yeah, and a lot of dating women do not do that, and they end up hurt. And then we end up reading magazine articles about them in Glamour and Cosmopolitan.
Yeah. So I would recommend anyone out there, got a young graduate going off to college, give them this book. And along with Dr. Seuss, All the Places You'll Go, and she'll be set for us, you know, for life at college. I'm going to just mention again that this is Cult of Gracie on XXBN from Raleigh, North Carolina. If you have a question for Amanda Brooks, you can call in at 646-200-3136. You mentioned now that you have a second book coming out this summer, you believe, on marketing and advertising, correct?
Yes. Online marketing and advertising. I definitely focus on the internet, but just to make that clear to people, yes.
Well, you know, this is how you and I first met, is over at the Marketing Whore, talking about this, because you have an interesting book which really plays up the issues of sex and advertising and marketing. We all hear sex sells, but those of us who are in any sort of adult oriented business know that you can't buy ad space. So it's sort of the reason your situation is so exaggerated is you're not selling sex or a body or even pictures of parts or, you know, you have a nonfiction series about a business.
Nonfiction, complete information. It's not meant to titillate in any way.
And so, you know, ideally you could see this sort of book serving, you know, how many message boards and websites exist for stay-at-home moms or work-from-home opportunities, which escorting totally, you know, offers that option. And I suppose you can't advertise any place there.
Oh, my God, no. I can only imagine the response if I even asked for ad space in one of those places. Oh, my God. To mix motherhood with sexuality? Oh, that you just can't do that.
Which makes you wonder how they became mothers in the first place.
Yes, well, apparently after a lot of these women become mothers, they become virgins again. But that's my opinion.
I would agree with you if we put this up to vote. What does your book offer, the second book, as far as is opportunities? Really, are you left with the world of the hobbyist? Is that what you're really left with?
No. Oh, good Lord. No. An escort, an online escort, has so many options, and it all starts with what she wants for herself. So she has to figure out what does she want for herself. How does she want to present her image? Well, figure out what her image is, how she wants to present it, how she wants to structure her business, you know, even how she wants to structure her rates. And then she figures out where she wants to advertise, because it's impossible to get any business if you don't do some type of advertising, even if your only advertising is to have a super popular blog. Some escorts do that. Others, you know, just have a lot of reviews, and they get their business off of that. Some have, you know, advertisements all over the place. Some have advertisements on one advertising site. It's always smart if you have a website or at least a complex blog. But there are girls who have certainly made their livings without having a website. And you can, I mean, the options are as endless as, you know, every escort that's out there. And then we go into, if you want a website, choosing a designer and some basics about how the internet works. And I even go into designing your own site if you actually want to do that. And I talk about photography and some do-it-yourself photography tips. And we close out with a discussion of how your marketing extends to your real life when you meet your client, how you look, how you talk, you know, your in-call or out-call environment, and also how to communicate with clients through email or over the phone or, you know, chats, discussion boards, that kind of thing. And I think that's about it, but it's like, it's well over 400 pages of options.
So if anyone wasn't paying attention to the first book where you wrote that it's 60 to 80% of your business as an escort is administrative and marketing and not actual client work, the second book should pretty much, you know, whap them upside the head with that, that those are pretty accurate numbers.
Yeah, the third book should be almost as complex because that's going to be the business administration book. The fourth book will probably be a little slimmer. It's going to be the life, you know, slash relationship slash retirement book. But, yeah, the second and third books are quite chunky.
Now, do you deal in any of the books with a more, okay, let's say I'm an escort and I'm having my website, my blog, and I've got my advertising out there. How to deal with the fact that, you know, your mom, your uncle, your neighbor might spot you?
Oh, yeah, that will be in book number four, the life, you know, relationship book. I definitely cover these issues, like, for instance, in photography in book number two, whether to show your face or not and possible consequences of that, or if you reveal too much on a blog, you know, things like that. I certainly, all these issues are intertwined no matter what you do throughout all your escort work, so I certainly touch on these issues, but, your personal life is slated for book four because that seems to be the thing that escorts care about least. They all want to know, where should I advertise and how much should I charge? And so I'm trying to order the books in order of escorts' general area of interest.
Yeah, but the issue of being spotted or discovered is, you know, if the media has shown us one thing, that's the story of escort and prostitution and sex work they want to cover is who they can out.
Yeah.
The Elliot Spitzer case continues to live on because Kristen, I forget her real name,
mm-hmm.
is now embroiled in that Girls Gone Wild situation.
Yes.
Have you heard about that?
Yeah, I haven't kept up to date on it. The last that I heard was that she was suing them.
Yeah, well, there's apparently videotape of her being interviewed by the Girls Gone Wild where her name is also begins with an A, her real name, but I can't remember.
Ashley,
and they were saying, you know, are you over 18? And she said yes, and there's a video of her showing her with her ID, which would have made her 20 at the time of the filming, and and they said, do we have permission to use this on Girls Gone Wild? And she says yes, of course.
Yeah, I'm thinking she's not going to win her lawsuit because she did indeed... Well, she gave consent, and she also lied about her age. So I'm not thinking she's going to win her lawsuit.
But these are the things that I guess, you know, I lived in relative anonymity. I mean, my friends in my inner circle, and certainly for safety reasons, lots of people knew what I did because they, you know, I had to hire security, and then I had friends who knew that just in case my security was going to go get drunk, you know,
yeah.
Even in a bar, you know what I mean? I had friends who would also know if I don't call back in by this time,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is what you need to do. But I wasn't on the 6 o'clock news, and I certainly wasn't on the, you know, cover of USA Today. So
yeah.
I think it's a real issue that sex workers need to address is, you know, you and I know you come out as a sex worker and you get a lot of heat and you get a lot of questions and things that really aren't any of their business, but now you're, you know, your life is up as public domain. And I guess that's something that I wonder how many escorts really think about.
I don't know. I honestly, I thought about it some as an escort, but not much because, again, I didn't expect anything spectacular to happen to me. I was just the girl next door, and that's how my escort career went. It's not until, you know, I started trying to get publicity for these books and stuff that suddenly I did get some public attention, and then suddenly I realized, oh, I'm getting public attention. And it's very disconcerting for somebody who, you know, has spent their life as the girl next door, just, you know, the average Jane. It is very disconcerting, and it's hard to know how to handle. That's actually a good topic to include in book four when I discuss life and relationships and, I guess, possible things that could happen to you. Because it does seem like they, now that they've got a taste for escort scandal, I have a feeling they're going to be trying to dig up, you know, an escort scandal every few months. That's my opinion, of course.
Well, and just the, even if it's not a scandal, just that you're, you know, I worked in a small town one time, and the closest outing I ever was I was at the local grocery store. And a client that I had met for the first time a few weeks before at an appointment rounded the corner with my shopping cart, and there he came with what I assume is his wife and his little red basket with bread and tomatoes in it.
No.
And he looked at me, and he looked away, and then he turned back, and he couldn't place me because I was, you know, ponytail and shorts makeup. And not that I looked horrible, but I was fresh, scrubby, clean, not when we were going out to dinner that night, you know, a little different. And so you could see on his face, he was running through, like, the meeting on Friday, no, you know, his doctor, no, you know, he was running through his list, and then all of a sudden it hit him, and he turned beet red, you know, as red as his tomatoes in his little red basket, and he's trying to act, you know, it's almost sitcom funny because he's, you know, almost grabbing his wife by the elbow, and then he thinks better of it because that'll be suspicious looking, and you know, and I just kept walking because I wasn't going to talk to him.
Yeah.
But when that happened the first time, I thought, you know, this could happen, you know, anywhere. I could go into my doctor's office and find out that the new person behind the desk is someone that I met, or that I'm being switched to a new doctor, and hello, surprise, you know. And it was something that was, you know, I think there's a certain element of surprise to that, which had I thought about it ahead of time, I mean, like, nothing horrible happened to me, but it would have been nice to have my head wrapped around that from the beginning, you know?
I certainly didn't think of that, when I first began escorting, and it never really occurred to me. Now it does. I don't know if that's older and wiser and more experienced or what, but, the internet, the internet can certainly track you down for you, and I see these escorts being so personal on their blogs, you know, giving out personal details of their lives, and it makes me cringe, because all that has to happen is somebody to Google certain phrases, and their blog will pop up, and whoever knows them will be able to immediately identify who that person is. And it's always inevitably somebody that they don't want to know. I mean, that's how life works.
Well, if the people you want, don't care if they know, or you've already told them. We had a columnist at Sex Kitten at one point who wrote for us for a while, and then she went, while she was in college, and then she went off to get a daytime, real grown-up job. And she came back to me about 6 months later, pleading and begging for me to change information on the website, because when they Googled her name, her employers were Googling her name.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And it was just her first name and her last initial, but it was tied through some social networking site that, you know, first name, last initial at this website. And so they were able to find this stuff, and she was just terrified that, you know, take it down because any of my applications and whatever. And I was like, they didn't teach you that in college, you know, how to keep your information, you know, a little more confidential. And I certainly didn't know. You know, I always asked them, what do you want to, what's name you want to write under? You know, so I had no way of knowing that was a real name for her.
Oh, here's a good story of naivete. Oh, my God, this is so embarrassing. But way back in college, I wanted more than part-time minimum wage payments. So I started trying to find work with escort agencies, and I went to this one agency in Dallas, and they hired me, and they had me fill out an application form, a standard job application form. So there I am, putting down my full real name, my street address, my social security number, my birth date, my mother's name, my mother's address, you know, emergency contact number, you know, my last three employers. I put down everything on the form. I mean, oh, my God.
Your PIN number on your ATM card, you know.
Yeah, everything. It was a job application form, and I was applying for a job, so I had to fill it out or I might not get the job. And, oh, my God. I mean, they did end up ripping me off for money, but as far as I can tell, they never did anything else with my information. I mean, they probably trashed the form, but, oh, my God. I mean, I was so naive. It scares me to think of girls doing such things today, especially with the internet. All somebody has to do is post their information up there, and it's up there.
Yeah, and getting it erased because of the replication. You know, someone else blogs it, someone else, you know, downloads a copy of it. It goes on forever.
So that now I don't lie. I lie for everything.
So we're really talking to Fred Smith from... Now, that was the one thing that I differed from you on in your first book was you're a little, I don't want to say, you know, anti-agency, but you're far more reluctant about agencies as a way to start out in the business than I am. Can you elaborate on that?
Because I've certainly had, my one bad experience with that particular agency, but I've also known a lot of girls who have had really bad experiences with agencies. And, of course, my base of knowledge is Dallas. Particularly, and there's only a couple of decent agencies in Dallas, and the rest are just as shady as anyone else. And that seems to be, from what I can tell, that seems to be pretty normal in most cities, is that the agencies are just really unethical, and they treat their clients poorly, they treat the girls even worse, and they just do all sorts of very bad things to girls. A good agency is a great springboard for an escort, because I've certainly seen that. There's an agency in Dallas that a lot of girls have started with, and they've gone into independent work, and the agency even links to their websites and everything. I mean, it's obviously a quality agency, but that is so few and far between, it seems.
Now, it seems like I was lucky, dumb beginner's luck, which I don't recommend for anybody.
Yes.
Like you, when I started out, I had well, let's get to the story first. You know, as a younger person, I considered escorting very early on. It did not seem taboo or scary or freaky. This was way before Pretty Woman or any sort of romanticized, you know, movies that I can recall of anything.
Oh, yeah.
I just really, the idea never really startled me. People's reaction to it was more confusing than the idea of it itself. And I know that you were Fox 3 times now, and that one of the times they have a quote of you as saying something about that you were dreaming of that since you were 4 years old or fourth grade or something.
Yeah, that was so misquoted. I dreamed about being an astronaut and a concert pianist and a writer and a kindergarten teacher and a veterinarian. I mean, I dreamed about a lot of things. Prostitution just was one of them.
And for some reason, it's more acceptable for you to want to take your bed sheet and put it on the back of your head and dream of being a bride handed over to a man like a piece of meat than it would be for you to consider economic livelihood in a controlled situation that you have power over.
That's actually one thing I never did dream about, to be honest. I got totally turned off the weddings when I was like 5 years old. I attended a wedding and saw the father hand over the bride, and I just thought it was the most repulsive thing I'd ever seen in my life.
I
became a feminist that day.
At five. Well, When I started out at escorting, it was lower money, college, you know, kind of college situation, and I didn't want to have to do the, come back in the summer and do the icky thing, and I wanted to stay where I was and stay there at college, and so I thought of escorting, and I picked up the yellow pages, and I flipped, and I looked, and I called the first number in the book, and I waited, and no one called me back, and then I went back home and did the stupid job, and the next summer the same thing happened, and I called a different agency and left a number and no one called. Only instead of just waiting, I waited like, you know, 10 days and then I called back. And at that point, I got a woman on the phone who was, you know, very much, you could hear her looking around to make sure no one was listening. And she said, "Let me take your number. I'll call you back later. I'll tell you something then." Very secretive, very strange, but for some reason I was compelled and I gave her my number and she called me back. And there was some sort of trouble at that agency. It was being run by someone who was not very reputable, and the several of the women there were not happy, and so they were going to start their own agency, which was really just going to be them and two or three other girls.
And you were fresh meat.
And I just happened to call at the right time, exactly.
Yeah.
So I met, and I said her name was Jade, and I started working with Jade, and I learned, you know, it was a very small agency, but I learned everything from, you know, what I was doing and not doing to, you know, screening. And there, you know, giving my license and stuff was just, you know, listen, we have to have our butts covered that you're not 13. Something bad goes down. I got, you know, So I gave my information, but not all of it like you did. There wasn't that
yeah.
kind of detailed form. But she had, you know, I gave her a copy of that because it was like, you know, I understood her situation. Someone comes here, you know, escort or something that's off to drag me into court for, to prove that it's prostitution versus escort and time. But underage is underage, you know.
Yeah.
If I can whip out and show driver's licenses, then we're fine. So we did that. So my experience with an agency was, you know, very, very, was an excellent education ground for me. But, you know, the first two shots probably would have been not so good, especially the second one with the drug involvement, I guess. But, you know, it was, you know, I was lucky that way. And, again, I didn't have any book back then. It was just sort of, hey, where do you start? Yellow pages, you know?
Oh, yeah, same thing for me when I was in college and trying to work for an escort agency. I got this, you know, weekly newspaper that had all these ads in the back, and so that's what I did is I started calling ads, you know, ads that I liked that it didn't seem too sleazy. And, I mean, I might have learned the ropes of the business with them, but they weren't a good agency. And that's until the Internet came along, that's how the Internet has changed things so much, or one of the ways it's changed things is it's lowered the entry barrier because, traditionally, anyone entering sex work has been mentored. I mean, that's how you enter the business traditionally. And the Internet has changed all that because now you can enter the business by slapping an ad online, you know, on any number of free sites.
Or you enter
the business. Yeah, and all of a sudden you're in the business and you have no mentor. You don't really know what you're doing. So I think it's very vital that there's a easily available reference that will at least give people a clue about what's going on. Obviously, I can't address every single possible situation, but at least it gives you a base to start from as opposed to simply hearing somebody say, put an ad on Craigslist, and then when they answer the phone, ask them if they're a cop or not. That's no way to run your business.
Well, and online, it is, you know, there's no way to really gauge, you know, if this person is dispensing accurate information or not, because their website can look very polished, you know, can have the latest gadgets and gizmos, and have the most horrendous advice within it. You know, so it's very hard to disconcert. Even for myself nowadays, I'll start reading something and think, wow, this post is actually very insightful and has something else, and two posts later, they're completely contradicting themselves, or they must have been stoned when they wrote it. I have no, you know, I can't even follow it. And I go, wow, you know, credibility factors. But if I had just come into that one page or that one post, I would have been impressed and, you know, written out my check, so to speak. So it is a complicated thing. I know you had interviewed other sex workers to write the series, correct?
Yeah, so I still haven't gotten to interview as many girls as I wanted to because, quite honestly, I'm totally open to lots of input. But I had a handful who answered some specific questions for me for book one, and then another handful that answered a very long list of questions for me for book two. And it's not because I didn't know what was going on or something. It was because I didn't want my perspective to be the be-all, end-all, quite frankly. I really wanted other input and other experiences so I could write from a much broader perspective than just my own. Because obviously, even when I do research, it's all filtered through my own eyes. I mean, I can't help that. That's how it works. So hopefully for book three, I'll get more interviews.
Did you learn anything from those other interviews that was surprising or different than your experience?
I did learn a couple of little things. One actually gave me a great tip for dealing with phone harassers that I was really happy about. And the rest was, it was opening my eyes that, okay, my experiences were not as abnormal as some people have tried to tell me that they were. So that was actually very reassuring, very affirming.
Yeah, because I like I said, I haven't, you know, been in the game for a while this way. And reading the book, I was like, you know, I hear some of these other stories and other sites, and I go, wow, have things changed that much? And I read your book, and I was like, no, affirmation, I'm not crazy.
Yeah, I don't guess it has changed, because if you look at it, it's really about human connection, and I don't think that's changed for the last several thousand years, really.
Right. Now, going forward with the series of books, you have more interviewing to do?
Oh, yes, definitely. I hope to get a lot more input for book number 3, and I will need tons of input for book number 4, you know, experiences with different life events and everything, because I really, really want to make book number 4 very comprehensive for escorts, because the whole issues of how it affects your life is just so important, and everybody has a slightly different situation, and people need to know what can be done in certain situations, especially in the drastic ones like, say, a child custody battle. I mean, I've got to be able to get interviews with escorts who've gone through that so they can help other escorts who are facing the same problems.
And if people that are listening want to help you by participating in your surveys or giving you some information, how should they contact you?
Just write me, Miss Brooks, at goldengirlpress.com, and just tell me that you'd like to be an interview subject for one of my upcoming books, and I'll stick your email in a special email folder so that I won't lose it. And when I start writing and have my interview questions ready, I'll just contact you.
The other thing that you did for these books is you interviewed clients, correct?
Yes, for book number 2, I had 47, 48 questions for clients. They were all marketing, advertising-related questions. I did not want to ask about sexual experiences because that's none of my business, frankly. But I did want to see what men thought about the marketing and advertising efforts of escorts online. And I was very pleased to see that they also confirmed, you know, my own conclusions. And so that information is definitely included in there, and I hope that it helps girls to see through the eyes of clients, you know, what they do and don't like about stuff, because girls might be surprised to find that good clients really don't care to see you have your legs spread open like a, you know, a hustler spread. They're perfectly happy if you actually have clothes on in your pictures.
Yeah, I think that the tease and the idea of mystery and working towards something is part of the desire to have an escort appointment, is that, you know, there's going to be a process involved here, because, you know, different from prostitution where there's some sort of act that you've caught.
Well, also,
for.
It also makes a girl appear classier and more worth her rate, as opposed to somebody who's available for anyone at any time. You know, the idea of restraint in public, of course, is you know, a little more upscale, a little nicer, and it will appeal to the better quality clients. They all still like to see boobies, though. They were all pretty adamant about that, but it wasn't an absolute necessity.
Well, and you mentioned a little bit of that in the first book, too, about boobies and the difference between the escort boobies and stripper boobies.
Oh, yes, yes. Clients definitely like real and natural because it feels good. And, I mean, again, actually, I just visited a male strip club this weekend, and I discovered that what looks good, you know, a really muscular-toned man, doesn't necessarily feel good because they're hard when they dance for you. They're hard as rocks. That's not necessarily, that's not necessarily sexual at all. So, again, stripper boobies might look great, but in an intimate setting, they don't really feel all that great.
Well, I think that was some of the affirmations in there in the first book about how you look, is that, you know, lots of men may admire the centerfold or the latest poster girl, clothes or not, but that when it comes to spending time with a person, that is not the main issue.
Mm-mm. No, in fact, you can make a man think that you are the most beautiful woman on earth if you make him feel good about himself. And if he thinks that you're totally into him, you become beautiful.
Yeah,
and
which
if you're
is why I think it's a great dating book. I really do.
Yes, exactly.
We'll just slap a different cover, a different tagline on the cover, and then say, you know, read this so you learn. It's really interesting, and I found, like I said, the parallels between that and how you would advise a niece or a, you know, recently divorced woman who's made mistakes. Now, hey, you know, next time put up these boundaries, think of these things first, don't go to that place without having anyone know, you know, just real common sense stuff, but all laid out for you.
I wonder if women resist these ideas because they're considered whorish.
Well, I think this goes back to that feminist thing, and
like
I know there's been a lot of great bloggers talking about this recently, about the, you know, what a lot of women who call themselves feminists learned from the feminist movement was that they didn't need to please a man. And some of them are saying, and I also don't need to please other women who can tell me if I'm a feminist or not. But I do think, you know, some of this feminism thing where, you know, all pornography is bad, to look attractive to beckon a man over is patriarchal, and to some extent that's true if you believe that's your only worth. But if a woman is heterosexual and wants a relationship with a man, it's got to start with somehow, which is going to be noticed.
And there is a huge difference to a man between a doormat who will do anything possible to please him and a strong, confident woman that he just becomes enthralled with because he can't truly conquer her. There is a huge difference.
Well, and just the idea of, you know, being a feminist does not mean, you know, if you're heterosexual that you're mateless.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to have to be at some point where you please a man. Now, taking feminism too far, in my point of view, is to say, you know, it's going to please you men if I wear a low-cut blouse, so I refuse to wear a low-cut blouse. You know, I mean, if every action is to be the opposite extreme, then that's not freedom. And feminism is supposed to be about equality, which means if men have a right to a sex life, then women have a right to a sex life.
But I think a lot of these extreme feminists don't think men have a right to a sex life because their sex life involves women, and they see that as just degrading. They see sex itself as degrading, which is just carried to a ridiculous extreme with some of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, you and I are certainly preaching to the choir with one another on that, and we're we're probably not poster child children for these people's campaigns, other than with a big red circle and a line through it. But you know, that's the difference with this book is that, you know, it poses the questions for you. What you want to do with that information is completely up to you, but a part of education is, you know, forming the questions, coming up with the answer yourself. You know,
like
you said, you're not telling anyone what to do. You're saying these are the situations. And okay, other than in the case of condoms, you know, you must wear one. You know, that the other decisions are really based on what is personally comfortable for you.
Yeah, because quite honestly, I would have appreciated reading this in college, sexual health section, because I took a lot of risk in college. Some of it was from sheer ignorance, and some of it was just from I'm going to defy the odds kind of thing. But it would have actually been very useful information for me in college, and hopefully I have written it, you know, in a way that would have been empowering enough for me to go ahead and make the right decision. So,
I'm a believer in sex ed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I think we need real sexual education. I mean, people should photocopy the pages out of your book with permission and take them to their PTA meetings and say, you know, this is what our kids need to know, you know, that a condom isn't 100% no, but, you know, going without one.
Yeah, it's a sure, I don't want to say death sentence, but it's a sure, it's going to lead
roulette.
To problems.
You know, it's the old Russian roulette thing. There's a bullet in the chamber and...
Well, statistically, given the odds of certain diseases, it's actually less than Russian roulette. I mean, Russian roulette's 1 in 6, and I think the current statistics of genital herpes is 1 in 3 or 1 in 5, depending on who you ask.
Well, it's not anything that we can dismiss anymore.
No.
I don't think. I don't think we can afford to dismiss. I always have the saying that makes everybody that knows me go crazy, but everybody poos, everybody screws. You know, you just have to come to terms with the fact that we potty train our children and we expect them not to go in the middle of Walmart. So we need to teach our children about sex and the same thing. Don't screw in the middle of Walmart. Other than, you know, and let's all, we've taught them the rules, they know the health and safety, they know what to do, and now we just trust that they will do it. You know, when they do it in the middle of Walmart, then it becomes my problem and I have to have them you know, have a consequence. But this other stuff is just sort of ridiculous to me.
Mm-hmm.
The body function. Well, is there anything else you wanted to say, Amanda, that before we go, we only have like about 10 seconds here?
No, not at all, except thank you for having me. This was a great conversation.
I wish we would have had someone
longer.
Call in. Well,
yeah.
We can keep taping. It'll keep taping for 2 hours.
Oh,
it'll
keep taping?
Yeah, it actually is taping right now.
Okay.
Anyone that's listening at the website will no longer be able to hear us, but it'll keep taping and it'll archive the show, including what
okay.
I'm just saying now.
Well, then I have one question for you that has been on my mind since you mentioned it several months ago, actually. Like a year ago, maybe, but you mentioned it again. We just didn't go into it. But how do you think phone sex operators would benefit from the book? That just intrigues me.
Well, I've been talking to quite a few of them lately at Sex Kitten, emailing back and forth, one of which is Secondhand Rose, who was an escort,
mm-hmm.
and
yes.
has found that the phone work that she does is really no different. It's the exact same client type of clientele. I mean, if you talk in marketing terms, it's the same demographic that has found her. And that 50% of her phone calls are not titillating or arousing. They're sexual conversations. They want to feel normal or watch a movie with me. Or, you know, I'm in a hotel room and whatever, and I'm feeling isolated and alone. They call her up.
Wow.
Which was a little surprising to me and to her at first. So we talked about that, you know, really this is proof that it's not,
not
all
about
that. And there are some differences, of course. But then with other, most of these are ladies that work at Night Flirt.
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps it's somewhat related to the site. I don't know. But, you know, they have the same issues of niche, how much to show, am I going to be pretty enough to compete with the Playboy models that are on there, you know, and the whole thing, like you mentioned in your book, you know, to try something first to see if you're okay with it, with an acquaintance or a friend,
mm-hmm.
and the same sort of things apply to the phone. You know, the first time someone calls you, it's still just as disconcerting.
I imagine it would be. You're on stage and you can't see the audience.
Yeah, and Rose was saying to me that it was actually freakier for her to do phone because when you're in person, you can read body language.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell if, you know, on the phone, she can't tell if that's a sigh of an annoyance or pleasure or, you know, he just bent over and picked something up and oofed a little, you know. She's like,
yeah.
You know, far less information for her to operate off of, and
mm-hmm.
but it was the same sort of issues, I guess, that the ideas of I don't know what I'm doing and I'm not sure about this,
mm-hmm.
and what if these things come up, and the idea of ratings and hobbyists and people telling you your
mm-hmm.
business, and feeling powerless or that they're going to be somehow faulted. You know, or that they don't please everyone, that's a problem with them, as opposed to that they just called the wrong number. So I've been recommending it to a lot of PSOs for that reason.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And that is interesting because I know that a lot of, you know, sex workers who have sex with their clients don't consider PSOs to be sex workers, and there's certainly been some amount of debate about this.
Yes.
But that... Yeah, that just, that sounds like sex work to me.
Well, you know, and that's the thing, Radical Vixen was talking about sex worker solidarity. I don't know if you've been reading her series, and she's had lots
yes.
of interesting people there. And my philosophy
yeah.
has been, like, you're writing erotica or you're writing, you know, nonfiction sex help articles, you're a sex worker. You're helping people with their sex lives. So you're bringing them, it's a matter of how directly you're working towards that orgasm. You know, are you the hand or the genitals involved and them achieving it, or are you the person who, you know, facilitates them through information or a fantasy? And I really don't, I think they're, you know, with each step further away from a possible STD you are, I see a lot of people in sex work want to diminish that and say, well, you're not, you know, you're not risking yourself to AIDS, or you're not risking yourself to imprisonment or
Does that define sex work, or does the work define sex work?
I've always been on the work. You know, if you're helping someone achieve a contentment with their sexuality, bringing them closer to an orgasm, then you're a sex worker. Whether that means you design, you know, vibrators or review movies or, you know, wrap them up for shipping at the store. I mean, you're helping at that. And the thing is, all of those people share in the stigma.
Yes, they
you
do.
Know, because you can't go to the family graduations in you know, this month in June and sit down and say, I'm a PSO, I work at Bob's Porn Shack. You can't say those things, just like you can't say I'm an escort, to, you know, just right out there in the middle of a family function. So, and if you went to court, you know, if you were going there for custody, if you were going there for anything, and they find out that you write erotica or that mm-hmm. you have a sex ed column, and, you know, it doesn't matter how respected the publication is, suddenly you're thrown into this unfit category or questionable category. And if you're a woman, it's... Yeah. You know, twice.
Well, if you're a woman, they automatically know you're turning tricks on the side no matter what you do.
Yeah, which means, like, not on the side. That's what I was doing up front. But, you know, I really, you know, I find that that's an alarming part for me in the social work of advocacy of sex work is mm-hmm. that people want to decry who's got it better, who's got it worse, and cut people out of it, and I think we need all the numbers we can. And I think
we do.
And I don't see how one is more or better or worse or lesser than, because fundamentally, at the end of the day, we're all going for the same goal, and that is that people be happy and healthy sexually. And whether they get that through a written piece of paper in a book or, I've heard some people argue that dominatrixes who don't actually touch, you know, and mm-hmm. deny orgasm aren't sex workers. Well, you're dealing with sexuality. And I just go, these are crazy little lines to draw. And
they're highly trained sexologists, in fact. A good dominatrix is certainly a highly trained sexologist.
Yeah. But
even if she doesn't actually have sex with her clients, she knows a lot about sex and sexuality.
And I think once we start cutting one another out of the circle, you know, I always go back mm-hmm. to that first they came, you know, they came for the Protestants, but I wasn't a Protestant. So, and I think it goes back to the same thing. If you want to say, well, I don't care what they do to prostitutes because I'm not a prostitute. I don't care what you do to pornographers. I'm not a pornographer.
Oh,
you know, I don't read pornography.
That's just shutting your eyes to a problem. And that's just.
Well, and I
because
think at the end
to
of the day,
the civilian world. Yeah, to the civilian world, we're all. Frankly, I said this on a recent blog post, but to the civilian world, we're all crack whores. Doesn't matter what you do.
And for us as a group to let them divide and conquer us, for us to say, well, yeah, I'm not as bad as, or for me to deny someone access to the, you know, the old sorority here by saying, well, you're not because you only work on the phone, mm-hmm. I think we do ourselves great harm that way, because fundamentally we're in the same thing together.
Yes, and we need the numbers. No change is going to happen if there's only 5 people here and 10 people over here and they all have different issues. The only way that's going to change is if we have the numbers and
well,
if we're united.
And, of course, sex work is hugely tied into feminism and women's rights because the majority of sex workers are female.
Mm-hmm.
And female, by being discredited just for the sake of gender, makes it much harder to legitimize the movement. I used to say that the only thing that was the lowest thing you could be is a woman. Then I realized that the worst thing you could be would be a gay male Native American in this country, because that's like the lowest can be is, you know, not show up on anybody's radar. But I think we need to realize that, you know, this is about sex rights. I know that at Swap East we talk a lot about decriminalization and labor rights, and I'm certainly not denying that those are important things, but. You know, it's so much bigger than that to me, because if we don't have a right to our sexuality and our bodies and decide who, you know, who and what does whatever, if people want to say that sex is sacred or that sex is different than some other economical livelihood, I think it's crazy, because I don't know about you, but I pay for my rent.
Yeah.
And I never once, you know, yelled at my landlord or anyone about my bill and said, it's unfair and disgusting and unethical and immoral of you to charge me for a fundamental human basic need, such
yes.
as shelter. You must
Actually,
be so disgusting. And how do you sleep at night when you charge someone for a basic human need?
Yeah.
But
the sex is sacred argument. Yeah, I'm beginning to get a more nuanced view on it because in many ways I do believe that sex is sacred, but by that I don't mean that it's supposed to be special. In this case, I think of it as a common sacredness. It is something to be shared. It is meant to be shared.
Well, but I think the difference is there's sex
But it doesn't mean
love.
Holy and special and separate from humanity because sex is so basic to our humanity, and I think it is meant to be shared. So it is special, but it's not special like, I don't know, a white rhino or something like that.
Well, what I always think of it is, you know, sex and love are, while not mutually exclusive, not the same thing.
Yes.
For me personally, they go best together. Okay?
Oh, of course.
And then I have something that I would consider more sacred. When I worked with clients, I was very aware of what I was holding in my hands, and I don't mean genitalia, but that I was holding someone's heart, perhaps someone's soul, because they were sharing to me and willing to participate with things that were very, you know, as personal as they get.
Mm-hmm.
And I was filled with awe and responsibility and respect for my position that, you know, this is a serious thing I'm dealing with here, is this person's story and this person's fantasy, and this is important, and this person needs to feel accepted. And I think there's great, you know, any sort of trust like that comes with a certain bit of sacred nature to it.
Mm-hmm.
But when people want to say, because you have sex for money, that you somehow, was that Diane Sawyer interview where she said, you know, don't you feel violated? And it's like, no.
I feel violated if they don't pay.
Well, I don't feel violated, you know. I have felt violated with sex. You know, I felt resentful, and these were people I was in relationships with, you know?
Oh, God, yes. Let's not get started on relationships. That can be so much more screwed up than sex work.
Because with sex work, the boundaries are really simple. It's
yes.
much easier to walk in as an escort and say, you know, I would say, don't do anal, don't do water, don't do cameras.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And fine. Try to say that to a guy you're dating after 6 months, and he's like, come on, just try it one more time for me. You know what I mean? It's like a client, usually you tell him once, maybe twice at the most, and he's got it. No means no.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to, you know, someone that you're dating or that wants to date you, and it's like they don't respect that line. But when it's money on the table.
Yes, one surprising thing I did discover is that men respect you a lot more when they're paying very well for your time than when they think you have all the time in the world to spend with them and that you're just this free thing lying around that they can pick up any time they want. They don't respect that, but they do respect it when they have to jump through hoops and pay you.
But I do think that's part of the self-respect that you have when you're in business. You realize that you're valuable. You realize your time is valuable. I've written more about this. I had a fairly famous client that I was supposed to meet. He was an athlete of some note. And
mm-hmm.
I wasn't supposed to work that day, but he had been trying to get me when he was in town, whatever, whatever. So finally they called me up and they're like, can you change your plans? Can you get there in 15 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
So I pull myself together, get, you know, appropriately addressed, get my mind, you know, into the right space,
mm-hmm.
go there. And I'm sitting in the parking lot where I'm supposed to meet him at this hotel for a check-in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting. 20 minutes, I don't wait long, but for a client, it was like, okay, 15 minutes is traffic. He's coming from the airport, right? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Okay. But 20 minutes, I'm foaming at the mouth, and I can no longer stand it. So I call in the agency, and I'm like, what's going on? He just called. His plane was 10 minutes late. I said, okay, that would explain why he would have been late 10 minutes ago. What's the story now? Let me call back and find out. So back and forth, a half an hour has gone by. I'm livid. And I'm driving out of the parking lot. I said, no way. But he's famous. I don't care who he is. I will not be treated like this by anybody. I said, is he going to pay me for the half an hour I'm here? No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then no.
Well, then, yeah.
And I put him, you know, we didn't have block lists in the real world like you do on the internet. So I couldn't block him. But I told him, don't call me for this guy anymore. I absolutely refuse. Oh, and he called for like 3 months straight, like religious, because was what he couldn't have, right? And
yeah.
The other girls were like blown away that I would turn down the money and the chance to be with Mr. So-and-so. And it was like, that's not what this is about. I'm not his girlfriend. And from what I see from his behavior and the way he treats people, I'm not going to apply. But, you know, it's stuff like that where, you know, you draw the boundaries. And I was like, and I dated, suffer no fools. You know, this is what you get.
Yeah, this is what dating women need to know. They need to understand that they have the power to do that. I don't know why I'm advocating for daters. I don't know.
And I don't think you'd even really need to change this book, to be honest with you. I would just give it a new, a new cover and a new forward, simply saying, you know, marketing directly towards them, or maybe even not even doing that, because I know that's expensive. But just letting people know, I mean, by the time I was done, I was like, wow. You know, I already knew a lot of this stuff, but to have it concisely said and with humor and easy to read, and some things were very, very basic, and I wanted to read the page, like, you know, I already know about waxing, you know what I mean? Like, but it was like, no, I'll read it anyway. And I thought, you know, this is the kind of thing that people, you know, need to have at their fingertips and to be able to look at and go, wow, you know, the things about the keeping yourself energized, how exhausting this kind of work is and how important it is. I mean, no one mentions that stuff.
Except for
dating
the
manuals.
The dating manuals. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, no,
you know,
nobody.
Go out and have a hobby, and you can't love anyone until you love yourself. But then when you fall for the guy, do everything about the guy. And you're very clear here, you know, saying if you want to attract a clientele, then this is what you do to attract a clientele. It, as a general rule, you were saying tattoos and piercings, no. Well, depending on your niche, I mean, if you're going to serve trendy, artistic crowd or something, maybe it's, you know, just like BBW or anything else, depending on your niche. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with what you're dating. If you want, you know, the old women in college for the MRS degree thing, you know, if you want to, you're only there to marry a doctor, then dress like you're there to marry a doctor, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And you'd have to change this if your idea of Mr. Right is something different than what you were specifically addressing as the target market for an escort making, was it $300 to $500 an hour roughly? Some of those things would change specific to you. But the idea is the respect and taking care of yourself and thinking about situations before they come up. Is race going to be an issue? Is weight going to be an issue? And being safe, I don't care who you are these days, you should not be going out with anybody without someone knowing who and where you are and who you're with. And if you're not home by this time or haven't called by this time, that they should know exactly what they're supposed to set into motion.
Mm-hmm. Yes, everyone needs a safe call system, but it's amazing to me that I think a lot of women, I don't know if they're in denial about their own possible risk or if they think it sounds too much like an agency outcall system and they don't want to be whorish about it. I wonder why women resist this idea, because I know that the BDSM community uses a, you know, safe call system when they go on play dates with people. So, you know, they're totally open and aware of the need for safety, but it seems that the main civilian population isn't, and I don't know why.
I think this kind of touches into a larger conversation, just a matter of what is community, how community is defined now. Because when I was growing up, I could run around my neighborhood, take my bike anywhere. I had a mile territories, you know, of where to go, the library by myself, the public pool by myself, you know, my grandparents' house, however many blocks away, you know, whatever. I could do the whole neighborhood. And now, you know, I watch my nieces or my nephews or whatever, and it's like around the block. You know what I mean? Like, that's it. I can't trust you to go three more blocks to the old downtown section because I don't know. You know, it's a whole different world. And yet when it comes to adults, we've, instead of shrinking our worlds as far as safety, we've been more lackadaisical about it. And we're like, well, I know I'm from online. My community is online. But if I email you, Amanda, and, you know, and say I'm going to be gone if I don't call you or email you by midnight, this is what you need to do. You know, you're not in the same place to do something as my sister next door.
No.
You know, or that kind of thing. And yet, even that would be a step up from
nothing.
from nothing. But I don't think people really are aware of a sense of community anymore, and they don't want to seem. It's almost like it's like inviting in the bad thought. You know, I can't treat him like he's a bad guy because that's inviting bad things. And it's like, no, acting like a stupid, naive ninny is acting, is expecting and asking for bad things to come walking through your door.
Yeah, I mean, I treated every client as though he were disease, not in a way that insulted him, not at all, but it just meant I watched out for my safety because I believed every client that walked in the door had something that I did not want to get. So I just, you know, minimized the risk, plain and simple.
And I always said, this is as much for your protection as it is mine.
Yeah, and I believe that
I've had a couple guys ask
because I kept my clients safe. They knew they were perfectly safe with me.
Yeah, I had one client who asked a couple times about oral, you know, in the beginning, come on without it, because, you know, it's not. And I said, no. And I said, and think about it. If I said yes to you, would you really want me to put my mouth on you?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end of it. Because if I was going to break down and do it for him, then that meant I had done it with how many other people potentially.
Mm-hmm.
So then it was not an attractive, appealing scenario anymore. So on went the condom, no questions asked. You know, it was done. But I think it's the same sort of boundaries that women, and men too, I'm sure that, you know, these things come up for men too, where women are, you know, no, but, or asking for things and whining for things, but, you know, if you set the boundaries up front, this is, listen, you know, no offense to you, you can like that all you want, I'm just not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And people are far more, I think I mentioned this to Joe one time, people are far more willing to defend their right and stand up for other hobbies and passions they're interested in. Like if you were dating a guy and let's say you love to play darts, Amanda, you're the best. You know,
I do actually like it, but I'm not the best. But it is fun.
You like it, and you and your friends, you every Thursday night you've got a dart league. You know, and you go, and it's like a really big thing for you. You look forward to every Thursday night to play darts.
Mm-hmm. I would actually.
And you're thinking now, you know what, there's a Saturday league forming. I'd like to do Thursday and Saturday, you know. And then your significant other comes to you and says, no more darts.
Mm-hmm.
People would go, are you crazy? Other than people in abusive relationships. But most people would go, are you crazy? It's darts. I've done it for, you know, 15 years, and I'm going to keep doing it until I don't want to anymore. And this is what I'm doing. But when it comes to sex, people go, you know, I like to cross-dress, I like to wear panties. My partner says, hell no, and you will never do it again. And they go, okay. And then they wonder why they're miserable in 5 months or 5 years.
Yeah, I've learned some big lessons lately about compromising, but we won't go into that.
But, I mean, it's the same thing with the, you know, I think that's why people go see escorts is because they didn't draw those lines for themselves early enough on and say, no, this matters to me. You know, I want... And then what happens is if you can't cross-dress with your partner or play darts with your partner, eventually you have this either resentment or trust issue between the two of you. And someone's going to feel lonely, and they're going to go looking for companionship, whether or not sex is part of it. And so I think looking at it from, you know, your book from that point of view of, you know, if you're drawing lines, that's good for you. Your clients will respect that, you know. And looking at it from the point of view of the client, you know, if they had been more respectful of themselves in their relationships, maybe they wouldn't be in a marriage where they couldn't have, you know, kinky number two platter at home, you know.
Yeah, I actually have not thought of that before, but I also think that leads to a bigger problem. One of my pet theories is that the bigger problem in society is that people enter marriage with really bad preconceived notions, and they don't honestly examine what they really want out of the relationship, whether male or female. I don't think they're truly honest with what they want out of the relationship, which is why it goes stale after 10 or 20 years, and they both, you know, stray off into their own little worlds because they weren't being honest with themselves to begin with.
Well, I think
that's a large part of the problem, frankly. I mean, people pin this on sex workers, but it's like, no, we're a symptom of the larger problem of people simply not being honest about what a marriage really should be for them as opposed to what they expect a marriage to be because that's what they've been told a marriage is.
Well, and I was I think this goes back to something I was discussing, and I can't remember who, and if she's listening, I hope she doesn't shoot me. With one of the PSOs, we were kind of in a chat one night, and so I can't remember which one said it. But we were talking about the you call it refrigerator complex. You're sitting home one night, and you're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really know what you're hungry for, so you paddle over to the refrigerator, and you open the door, and you look at the stuff on the shelf, and you're like, leftover pizza, no,
mm-hmm.
carrot sticks, no, yogurt, no.
That's me every night.
And then you open the refrigerator, you know, the freezer, and you're like, fish sticks,
uh-huh.
no, and then you go to the cupboard, it's like peanut butter, crackers, no, 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 and you're like, nothing. So you go back to the couch, and then like 15 minutes later, you're like, oh, and you get up and you walk there, nothing's changed,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it's not until you go, oh, my God, I need a chocolate-covered pretzel. And then you're willing to go put on your shoes, you know, put a bra on, comb your hair, mm-hmm. put a hat on, and drive.
Well, at that point, at that point, you're obsessed.
Well, yeah, but you know what
you
it
won't
is
rest
that you
until
want.
Yes. You won't
but
rest
so many
until
people
you get
just
up.
Sort of, yeah, you have to sit there and think about it. Now, what is it? What is it? No, is it sweet? Is it salty? Is it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But people just, so many people live in what we call that refrigerator complex, where they're just, you know, this isn't quite right, but I can't complain because he or she is, you know, they're not hitting me, they're not, you know, they're good to the kids, they're, you know, or whatever it is, and they go, there's nothing to complain about, but I'm just not satisfied. And they just live there in that
mm-hmm.
constant opening of doors and going, no, not really. Instead
yeah.
of sitting down and thinking to themselves, I want a chocolate-covered pretzel.
But sometimes,
you know,
based on recent personal experiences, once you figure out you want the chocolate-covered pretzel, though, it can be so painful to go and get it.
Yeah, it's a pain in the butt. Some days I hate putting a bra on, you know. That's some reasons why I like winter, because you can put a coat over it and not have to worry about it. Otherwise, in summertime, it's like you draw attention. But, you know, it's like they're just doing whatever they want. Thank you. But, you know, I think it comes down to personal accountability, which is part of what you're, you know, the first book especially was about, was that the fact that you have to come to these decisions. You're not going to spoon feed them the answer, because the answer is about what's best for them. And so they're accountable to themselves to make these decisions for how am I going to be safe? How am I going to professionally draw a line for myself that,
yes,
and ask them to respect it.
Yeah, recent media attention makes it out as a how-to manual for escorts. And while that's tempting, I don't refer to the series as such. I call it a reference series. But it's tempting to fall into that trap of calling it a how-to manual, but it isn't, because every person's situation is different, and I cannot possibly tell every individual this is how you should do this, because I don't know.
I reference it as a how-to, and that's because it's a how-to evaluate manual.
Oh, that's
so
a good way of looking at
it.
It's
not a how-to as a list of step one, step two, step three, check them, you know, I have nails, here's the hammer.
Mm-hmm.
Tap them in a quarter of an inch. It's, you know, these are all the things you need to think about. And you're going to have to come up with what works for you, unless it's going without a condom, in which case I'm going to come to your house and hit you with a hammer. It'll be safer than going without one. But, you know, that there's some things that are just really, you know, that you know, it's like you can't tell someone that they should or shouldn't have whatever kind of sex, and I hope our government is listening. Which me, they probably are listening right on my phone line. But you know, that's the kind of things that were covered in your book. And there were some things that were very practical that, you know, like, you know, even with your period, there's practical ways around that. But these things might not all work for each of you. You know, what are you comfortable with? I just didn't work then.
Different.
At the amount of money I was making, it was great to have a week off. So that's one question for you. What's it like to go from escort money to author money? That's a huge cut, even with you being a publisher. Publisher and writer author money are still, what percentage of escort money, right?
Like nothing, or like 0.001? God. The business is still forming. I mean, it's been doing better the last couple of months thanks to the attention I've gotten, but I've got to pay for the production of book two, and I'm really hoping that book two will sell well enough that I can actually put some real money into the business and start producing others' work. But you still don't hear that I'm paying myself, you know, anywhere in this, do you?
No.
No.
Having an involvement with a small publishing company myself, I understand. It's not just a labor of love. It's a an issue like OCD that should really be looked at by a professional.
It's not just pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. It's creating the boots first and then pulling yourself up by the bootstraps.
Yeah, and deciding that you're going to make bootstraps out of tinfoil and duct tape and canned corn, create, you know, like canned corn, because that's all you've got. So I will make something out of this today. But, yeah, it's a huge thing, and that's why, you know, a book like this for people, you know, who are tempted by the idea of money, to understand that it is a business, that there is work involved, but that if you're smart and you're safe and you're treating it as a business, you know, there's money to be made here.
Yeah, there is. I'm not going to lie to anybody, because if you're charging several hundred dollars an hour and you're a popular girl and you manage your money well, yeah, you're going to make money. I mean, that's how it works. But if you're charging several hundred dollars an hour and you're a complete flake and you spend your money as soon as you get it, well, you're not really making money.
Well, is that something you're going to address in one of the other books about money management?
Yes, book number 3.
Yeah.
Yes, most definitely.
That was something else that I observed through the agency during that short time was, along with Tiffany, who didn't shower and answered the door with bed hair, which I didn't believe until I actually went and saw one day.
God.
Had to drop somebody off there that was going to drag her along for security or something. I forget what, but I came to the door, and I was like, holy hell. You know, wow. You look like an after-school special. But, you know, I also witnessed some other people that were not, you know, I worked back in the day when it was, you know, pre-cell phone pretty much for most of us. It was pager. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'd go home with, you know, $1,000 in my pager clip.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched other girls, you know, they went out and bought, you know, an outfit or a bunch of booze or concert tickets for all their friends, and then that was it. You know, I went home, paid my rent, and put the rest in, you know, for when I work on my own. You know, I'm going to want this, I'm going to want that for my business, so I had to put the money aside. But I, you know, it's like anything else, you get money fast. You know, you forget, some of them forget that, you know.
Yeah, so yeah, the books definitely aren't how to make money necessarily, because that's really up to the individual. And again, that's something I cannot control, and I'm not going to pretend that I even want to control it. I do really want people to be good escorts, and I want them to keep themselves safe. That's so important to me. But, you know, what they do with their lives or their business decisions, or if they do swing from the chandeliers with their clients, I really don't care. That's their business.
Well, that's something else I wanted to mention about the I think I remember was it a review in Spread?
Mm-hmm.
There was one slightly negative comment, and they felt that you were negative, unnecessarily negative towards prostitutes or something.
Oh, no, that wasn't Spread. That was the Electronic Journal of Human Sexuality. Yes. Yes. Yes, he felt I made a negative comment about prostitutes, but the comment he was referencing was simply my fault of not writing clearer, and so that's certainly something that can be changed in the next edition. But no, I don't look down on prostitutes at all, because, you know, there's something for everybody out there in the world. And so
I think
just because they're different, yes, there is a difference, no doubt about that, but it's not one difference of one better than the other, although it can be a difference of one makes more money than the other or one is less safe than the other, but that doesn't mean one is better than the other because, again, it's
Well, I don't think prostitutes
situation.
Need to be less safe. I mean, you know,
well, it often is
prostitute
due to
with
laws.
Yeah.
Due to laws, they tend to be less safe, unfortunately, than indoor prostitutes.
But I think the big difference between when I was, because after I read it and then I went and I looked at reviews, because I don't like to read reviews beforehand because I feel like I'm looking for that thing that they pointed out to. And I was reading afterwards and I thought, wow, I didn't even get that. You know, I was, like, scrounging around for the page or whatever, and I was like, oh, I guess. But my point was you were very clear in the beginning that you were writing this for escorts and in a certain dollar bracket, you know, mm-hmm. an hourly rate, if you will, that was clearly a target market. So to expect you to cover or not compare yourself to other things. You know, you weren't writing the giant resource sex worker guide that covered dominatrixes and
oh God, no.
And everything
not
else.
A million years.
Well, and that's the other thing we were talking before about who's a sex worker and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I haven't had time to actually research this, but most people tend to not include porn stars or actors and actresses as sex workers.
They certainly are.
Well, by my wide definition, they are. But I was wondering, why is this? And then I realized, and a lot of it was distinctions being made by the pornography industry itself, which I thought was...
Oh, yes. They don't want to be associated with illegal activities.
But I think what it comes down to is that pornography has its legal leg, you know, only one leg that they can stand on at this point, firmly entrenched in the fact that they are creating fiction or a movie or entertainment, and that, remember back, was it Deep Throat? People were arrested for having sex for money because that's what the actors were doing, is they were being paid to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were trying to draw this distinction between acting, you know, that when you portray a murder or you simulate a domestic disturbance, you're not really perpetuating violence upon a person or emotional abuse, you're acting. So that was the definition for actors in pornography films, that they were, the distinction was made. So I'm finding that very interesting, that these little, and I can understand, you know, because they're being harassed greatly right now, that they would want to try and keep themselves as squeaky clean as they can in certain areas. But really, I think, again, it's the divide and conquer, that we should be linking our arms and, you know, saying Red Rover rather than abandoning one another. Because, you know, you and I with linked arms, we're, you know, when the Bush administration launches Cheney at us, we aren't going to be able to hold him, you know. So, but if we have our arms linked with a bunch of other people, then we have a chance of holding him. And I think that's where the stability lies. And I think part of that is fundamentally based in the general population's acceptance of sex as a valid basic human need, and that we allow people to charge us for food and housing, and those are basic human needs. So, you know, we should be no more or less demonized than those other people.
Yeah, that's a great argument. But, yeah, I've always been bothered by the porn industry's removal of itself or disassociation of itself from all other forms of sex work, except maybe a little bit of stripping, you know, because the porn stars will do stripping tours. But beyond that, I've always been bothered by their desire to remove themselves from every other facet of sex work when it's essentially all very much the same in the broad sense.
And I noticed, since I've been hanging out with those knife work girls, I've noticed quite a number. And they seem to be as legit as far as from what I can research, because they're linking to the actual websites and whatever, and their photos of Playboy and models that are on Night Flirt with webcam. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So I've been really kind of interested in this, because Night Flirt's been around for a while, and I looked at it when it first started and didn't really, I made the account, but I didn't really do anything there. And now that I've been talking to more of the phone sex operators, I've been sort of intrigued by what's going on there and seeing this, and I'm thinking, wow. So, you know, because for a centerfold to be, you know, headlining as a stripper wasn't unusual. But now to be doing phone work and cam, and I'm talking with insertion, et cetera, not just...
Yeah, and interacting directly with her clients. Yeah, she is definitely a sex worker.
Yeah, that's how I view it. But I find it really interesting that...
Well, and what about the porn stars that tour around the country and take escort appointments?
Yeah. See, I think there are lines, and the only time I pay attention to them is when they're in my personal relationships. You know, my partner and I am... He and I have discussed this quite a bit. We just had a conversation the other day. I was shocked to find out that, in an article, there were some women and men that were greatly incensed and felt that a partner talking to a phone sex operator was infidelity.
Oh, some people draw the most bizarre lines as far as infidelity.
I said, okay, in your relationship, I won't argue that. You know, you guys have agreed where your lines are, or I hope you have. But then explain to me the difference between someone speaking a fantasy to your partner over the phone and your partner reading penthouse letters or, you know, reading the story of O or Lady Chatterley's Lover or, you know.
That person probably would be incensed by their partner reading such things.
They said no because it's a book. And there isn't
really
a human interaction. And I was really surprised. This is why I find these little distinctions that are intensely important to individuals, you know, and they should be in their relationship. But, yeah, they really are, you know. So that's like this distinction of what's a sex worker versus what isn't. I find that within the group when people say no, you know, throw out a phone sex operator or they, you know, porn stars or, you know, the legal versus not legal jobs, or they make these distinctions, and I go, but really? What really separates us is, you know, it's you know, it's smaller than the differences between male and female, and that's like 13 to 26%. So it's like, really, we're talking about really small little definitions here, which in your personal relationship, if you're clear with your spouse, and I don't think a lot of these people are, but if you're clear with your spouse and you say, you know, you're committing to me and that means no sex workers of any sort, or you can read but you can't talk or touch, or, you know, whatever those rules are, you know, that you need to do that for your personal relationships. But when you look at the big picture of legal versus not, or socially acceptable versus not, or in our group or not, I find these distinctions almost, they'd be flat out amusing if they weren't painful to watch how the divide and conquer happens. Because, you know, I think a lot of sex workers aren't paying attention to pornography laws like they should, because I don't think they understand what that can mean. You know, and we publish some erotica, and so I'm very concerned with that. Because if they're going after the U.S. mails and transport of obscenity, what is that going to mean for book sales?
Well, I also
wonder
what
it will
mean
34
for
years ago that was illegal. Yeah.
Yeah, well, because mine has STD information. And way back when, you know, turn of the century, the woman, I forgot her name, who founded Planned Parenthood.
Was it Sanger?
Yes, that's right. And she was sending out those little birth control pamphlets by mail and got thrown in prison for obscenity for that. I can see us coming around to that point again.
Yeah, so it's real intriguing to me, and I think a lot of people go, well, you know, I'll hear erotica authors complaining that they can't advertise or promote their book at this or that site because it's too explicit, but, you know, the bodice ripper can, or, you know, this or that, and people complain about it. And I'll say, yeah, and it stinks to be you, but there's always some other group under attack, too. We really have to pull together, because I was talking to... So it's a while ago. I did an article for XBiz, and I was talking about people in charge of Hearst Publications and other big magazines, and asking about their policies, because I said, you know, your editorial content, you know, I was asking them a survey question, so I was like, how much do you think is sex-related? And they all kept saying it wasn't sex-related, it was relationship-related. And they would say it was anywhere from 26 to 46%, depending on the publication. Mm-hmm. And they had ads for Sex and the City, and interviews with Sex and the City stars at the time, but they would not allow the rabbit vibrator to be advertised. The manufacturers could not pay for an ad.
Oh, God.
And so I was trying to be polite and not have them hang up on me, but trying to broach the subject of what makes it okay for your editorial content but inappropriate for an advertiser.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept coming back to, well, when subscribers complain. And I said, so you're saying... a subscriber who's paying for your magazine to read about, you know, Kim Cattrall and all this. She loves Sex and the City, and she's excited about this interview. She's going to be upset to see the ad there?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing where I said I really think as a group we need to push those boundaries. And I know I talked to Jill about it regarding this, that there's this, you know, a lot of organizations come from the labor point of view, and I agree with that, but I've always worked from the opposite end of you know, the cultural point of view, why would we make such silly distinctions about these things? Because they're really not as complicated as people want to make them out to be. You know,
no,
I don't think the ad is going to offend the reader.
Yeah, well, I doubt that, especially in a woman's magazine that publishes racy interviews with Sex and the City, because, I mean, I've read interviews like that in Glamour magazine, and those interviews can get really explicit.
But if you flip through Glamour, you won't find the ads that you would kind of expect to find. You know, same thing with Cosmo. You won't find the vibrator ads and those things. If they are, they're buried in the back, and they're one of the things that they were very clear about is that lack of images. That there were sometimes, if they were called, you know, the old school personal vibrator, personal massager, just, you know, the little classified black and white text ad, you might find some of those. But if you're, you know, but if I'm the maker of the rabbit vibe that was mentioned in Sex and the City, and I know that the stars are going to be interviewing that issue, I want my ad right there. You know what I mean?
And these are, they have sex articles all the time, every month, and they get very detailed, and they certainly discuss toys. I mean, good Lord, they certainly discuss toys.
But the ad, but they can't be in there as ad content. Not even under the guise of, you know, marital assist DVDs that are completely not, you know, they're not at all, could not be considered pornography. They're not fictionalized fantasy scenarios. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, how to Kama Sutra or, you know, prostate manipulation and that kind of stuff. And
I
they
subscribe
won't
to Playboy.
Let those.
Yeah, I subscribe to Playboy, and they definitely don't have problems with those ads. They definitely don't have problems with sexy ads.
Yeah, but most of them, I mean, because there's a difference between having, you know, most, if you went into the average American home right now, how many of your friends that have kids have Cosmo or Glamour laying around?
Oh, yes.
But not Playboy. But
that's
really,
true. That's a good point.
My friends and I sat down one day and I said, now start flipping open Cosmo and start thinking about what your 11-year-old who can read would be reading if she were bored and sitting here and willing to grab your Cosmo.
Yeah, it's pretty,
you know,
shocking.
I mean? Yeah, which I'm not saying that 12-year-olds shouldn't read Cosmo or they should. What I'm saying is unsupervised, you know, that they have access to it. You're not even giving it a thought because it's just a magazine laying on the, you know, coffee table or whatever that you put down. Mm-hmm. But you would never leave Playboy laying around. But Cosmo's okay. And I have nothing against Cosmo other than I think ever since Helen Gurley Brown left, it's been a sad excuse of a magazine.
Yes.
I'm showing my age. But, I mean, I really think they've become boring and trite.
Yes, they have. It's turned kind of high school. Helen Gurley Brown made it definitely woman.
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting that where we draw these lines, and I find them, like I said, they would be completely amusing due to how arbitrary they are if it weren't for the fact that it affects us all and that most people seem to be really apathetic to that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one thing that activism does is it raises your awareness, and then you're never quite happy with things because you constantly see these problems. Well, I mean, the problems aren't like this are constant, unfortunately, but it's just sometimes it can get a bit much to have your eyes opened. I don't know where I'm going with this point, but my book publishing experience certainly opened my eyes to a lot, even more than the activism did, because I did this before I got involved with the activism, and God, it was such constant slap in the face, one after another. It was just...
Bookstores that won't carry it because it's, you know, too outrageous, but meanwhile, your book does not need to be carried, you know, no one's going to card anyone who wants to buy your book. You know, you go to Barnes & Noble, and the few erotic things they have, which aside from a few Violet Blues best of, you know, 2006 and whatever, all they have is the Penthouse Letters things. But
yeah, which in my opinion
kids,
definitely
if 13,
screw with sexuality.
If you're 13, you can walk in there, pick up either one of those books, walk to the counter and pay for it and walk out. There's no law. But they won't carry them in the stores because they're, quote-unquote, you know, obscene or mature or adult or whatever word they like to use. And I'm going, but it's a nonfiction book. But it's like even just getting press releases sent out. It doesn't matter that it's nonfiction. They won't carry it on the news service. And, you know, stuff like that, I'm sure you've experienced. It just blows your mind where you go, well, this isn't an illegal product. This isn't even an age, you know, age-limited product.
Well, when I was getting it published and working through trying to find printers and stuff, it was amazing that people would ask me about the content of pornographic pictures and the content of violence in the book, which just floored me every single time. I guess it shouldn't have, and I should quit being so easily shocked. But, yes, they asked me, always asked me about the content of violence in the book. What did they think I was creating a book about violence against women or that I was celebrating violence against women? I still don't know where they came up with this, but several printers asked me about, you know, the level of violence in the book. Like they care about violence against sex workers.
Well, yes. It's on their voting platform, issue number 2, right up there with women's reproductive care. It's right up there. Because I'm not jaded or sarcastic at all. Well, I suppose, Amanda, we should wrap this up. Poor people who have been, you know, 2 hours
very patient.
They now need to get little wire brushes to scour their brains clean. But it was great, and I hope to have you come back again because I would really like to hear more when you have book number 2 out so we can talk more about those issues.
Great.
People. And thanks for everything you do.
Oh, thank you, Gracie. I was very happy to be on here, and I'd love to do it again.
Okay, we'll give you a call then.
All right.
This is Cult of Gracie signing off for XXBN Raleigh, North Carolina. Good night.